What I want to talk with you about tonight is something that turns out to be an enormous, huge, giant fact and interpretation-filled topic. In fact, I was talking with Dr. Brown just before we started here, and he asked me, what are you talking about tonight? And I said, well, this topic became so large and so complex that I decided that I needed to start with a preface or chapter one or an introduction or something like that. And maybe succeeding presentations can delve more into the operational specifics. But what I want to get at tonight is an introduction to Air Force ballistic missile systems and some of the concepts attached to that in the period of the Cold War. So I'm drawing my box around the Cold War, and not before and not after, and strictly Air Force ballistic missile systems. Otherwise, if I start talking about SNARK and Bomark and things like that, then I'll get off track, even though you could say that some of that was ballistic. But you see how I wander. What I want to cover is something of the origins of Air Force ballistic missiles, the why and the how. Why did we get into these things, and how did we go about it? A look at operations, including some thumbnail sketches of the major ballistic missile systems the Air Force has used since the late 1950s all the way up until today. And also some brief thoughts or some definitions, some things to chew on regarding the effects. What happens to military doctrine when you have weapons that can strike such a hammer blow at such tremendous distances and they're unstoppable? What happens to planning? What happens to strategy? And what terms have we adopted over the years to describe these situations? I'll go over just a few of those. The terms that especially those of you who are museum volunteers should be familiar with when you're talking with visitors about missiles and the Cold War. Because, as you know, so many of our visitors have not lived with that sword hanging over their head so much as the older ones of us have lived with that. And so having these terms close at hand is, I think, going to be useful to you as volunteers in dealing with visitors. And I'll talk about some things about doctrine and command, and I'll end up with some thoughts about arms control and how, in a sort of irony, we've had a growing and growing and growing and more efficient and effective nuclear deterrent while at the same time trying our best to get rid of it. So this central irony of the Cold War is the inexorable growth of nuclear deterrence and attempts to shrink it for mutual benefit at the same time. So starting with why develop missiles? The V-2, which you can see one of in our air power gallery, this pointed the way toward the future. The Germans developed the V-2 as long-range artillery. That's how they thought of it. They didn't think of it as ballistic missile. They thought of it as self-powered artillery shell. It's a fundamentally different kind of approach. This was, to them, long-range artillery controlled by the Army. Now, if you've looked at the V-2 that we have and the interpretation that goes with it, you'll learn that this weapon was not militarily effective or efficient. It certainly inspired terror, but it was nothing like efficient, and it was nothing like accurate. It was only terrible. And as I said, for details on the V-2, go and look at the one that we've got. You'll see a fearsome weapon that is surely immature in hindsight. It was before its time and unsuited to its time at all at once, another irony to consider. But what the V2 did conceptually was to give us a ballistic missile paradigm. And apologies to those of you in the Society for the History of Technology who cringe when you hear the word paradigm. By paradigm, I mean an example that serves as a model or a conceptual framework. And this is what the V2 did for succeeding systems, the missile systems that came after it. We conventionally think of a ballistic missile as including a couple of things. A warhead whose power and design we consider as progressing along some sort of linear path toward more powerful and better and more explosive. Guidance systems that we tend also to think of as on a linear path toward more accurate, less inaccurate, more reliable, smaller, lighter. Propellants that for many years were thought of as combinations of liquids that you could use to propel your rocket, and more recently, solids that you could use to propel your rocket. But propellants, a major player in the paradigm. And finally, advanced engines. Who can make the most efficient rocket engine that provides super thrust for weight and maybe is throttleable and so on? These things altogether comprise the paradigm of the ballistic missile, which the V2 popularly provided for us. Now, that's not to say that these things weren't thought of before, but the V2 and its the popular notion of the V2 at the end of World War II brings all these things together in a big rocket in a way that we can think of as specifically and identifiably related to what came in the decades after. I want to talk about just a few people. There's a lot of machines in my talk tonight, and that's because it's sort of a thumbnail sketch of the force, but there are some people in it, and I would like to talk more about pioneers and people in succeeding lectures. Maybe Bonnie will let me do another lecture on this at some point. Some of the most notable early expertise is provided by Wernher von Braun. He was imported, with big quotation marks around it, imported after the war with more than 100 other German experts to work on a U.S. missile program. The Russians got some and we got some, and we basically had a contest to see whose Germans were better. The Germans in Russia worked very hard, and the Germans who came to the United States and went to New Mexico worked equally hard. The U.S. exploited both the equipment captured from the Germans and also their knowledge to start or jumpstart or contribute to a U.S. missile program that was really disorganized and scattered and in its infancy in 1945, 46, 47, 48. Von Braun and his team worked at White Sands, New Mexico, and later at Huntsville, Alabama, at the Redstone Arsenal. Of course, meanwhile, the Russians were racing at breakneck speed toward what turned out in the early days to be a more organized and effective missile program. The other individual that I want to highlight, and every time you hear me talking about missiles, you're going to hear this guy's name, General Bernard Schriever. He is far and away the most important of Air Force missile pioneers. He is rightly called the father of Air Force space and missiles. His most important contribution, it wasn't like he sat there at a drafting table creating the missiles, but instead it was joining high tech and the Air Force. General Schriever's contributions are where the Air Force becomes really, really high tech in a kind of Silicon Valley, California sort of way. Schriever streamlined Air Force research and development by introducing the concept of concurrency. It's also known as the systems approach, which transformed traditional step-by-step design and production and testing and facilities preparation and training into a simultaneous time-saving process. All of those things happened at once. Not all at the same time, but they overlapped a fair bit. So while you were designing things, you were also testing things and fielding things and training people, and in turn the loop turns back on itself and you design again. All of this saves time and money. The concurrency process integrated all the functions needed to create new systems. And in doing this, General Schriever and the Air Force obtained workable results, that is, fielded and deployed effective systems, faster than many experts predicted that they could. If you have spare time to read, compare this to the Army's arsenal system. And you will see that the concept of concurrency in the systems approach really was something different at the time. We do everything at once now, so it's not uncommon to us, but try this with typewriters and carbon paper and telephones. This was a new thing then. On to thumbnail sketches of some of the systems that we've used over the years. Of course, here's Schriever again. he appears in a lot of these pictures. The Atlas missile, operational from 1959 to 65. It was the first operational U.S. intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM. And that acronym should be right on the tip of your tongue whenever you're anywhere near the Space Gallery. That's a one to know. Atlas served both defense and NASA needs. Recall, NASA was created in 1958 with a lot of technical help from the Air Force. Atlas was used in the Mercury program, notably, and it worked very well. The missile turned out to be a proving ground for lots of new missile technologies and the organizations and policies that General Schriever created. Some technical facts about it. Its range was between 6,400 and 9,000 miles, and Convair built the airframe. Quick note about the airframe. It wasn't built like an airplane. It maintained its shape by being pressurized. In other words, it was like a very large soda can. It was unable to stand up under its own weight. It had to be pressurized because the walls were so thin. They served as the fuel tanks, too. So that's a big difference from a lot of missiles. It's very, very thin-skinned. But, boy, when it was pressurized, it did everything that it was supposed to do. Six variants were built. Three of them saw service. The Atlas D, E, and F were deployed. The most notable historical fact about Atlas and the early ICBMs is that, especially Atlas, urgent deployment was the theme. Let's get them online as fast as we possibly can, because the Russians are doing the same thing. So it's all about speed. They were initially based above ground. In fact, there's a famous photograph of three of them on alert at Vandenberg Air Force Base with a B-52 flying by. Those are right out in the open. There they are. That's a stopgap measure while we're getting more missiles online. So initially it was above ground, and then in these kind of horizontal coffins above ground, and then in coffins below ground, and finally with the F model in silos. So with Atlas, you get that learning curve about not only having your missile work, but also protecting your missile. This is all Atlas. Thor is next on the agenda, operational 1959 to 63. It was developed in only 3.5 years, and the speed of that development, again, was spurred by fear of the Soviet Union doing similar things. Thor was a stopgap, and it was retired when Atlas became reliably available. Thor was an IRBM, an intermediate range ballistic missile, and therefore couldn't be based in the United States because it couldn't reach its target. It only had a 1,500-mile range, therefore it had to be based in the UK, That was the place that we found an agreement to base them. Thor had a short career as a weapon, but many spin-offs from its basic design. It's seen many, many years of reliable service and adaptation into the Delta series of space boosters. You can see Delta's in service now. Thor served very well as a launch vehicle in the early Corona satellite program, or Discoverer, depending on if you're talking, you know, NASA publicity or Black World observation reconnaissance satellites. And it also served in atmospheric nuclear tests. So interesting history behind Thor, but very brief history as a weapon system. Its guidance, by the way, was all inertial. In other words, somebody set the gyroscope spinning, told the missile where it was, and then it found its own way from there. It was built by Douglas Aircraft. I found this map, and I just couldn't resist tossing it into here. Here are the Thor bases in the UK. So with only 1,500 miles of range to work with, not only do you have to base it in the UK, you have to base it in the eastern UK in order to get it where it's supposed to go. If you do a little Googling on the internet, you can find some people have a Thor museum at Feltwell, I think. And the locals have photographs of Thors being towed through town and so on. It's very interesting. Next up, Jupiter. Operational 1960 to 63. Another intermediate range missile based in Italy and Turkey. And this one was originally an Army and Navy project. And here's a way that you can really see how politics is embedded in objects. Some people may ask you, why does Jupiter look like a crayon? Why is it sort of short and squat? I thought missiles were supposed to be, sort of long, tall, thin, sort of elegant things, and this one just is squat. The reason is the Army and the Navy compromised. The Army wanted a 90-foot missile, and the Navy wanted a shorter one for shipboard use. That would make launching from a ship much easier. They compromised on a 60-foot missile, and it came out looking like that. Now, due to politics and inter-service rivalry, the Navy backed out of the program. The Army kept going. But then the Air Force got the go-ahead to manage all the missiles. So the Army ended up building Jupiter as a subcontractor to the Air Force, which made the Army upset. But there you have it. Why does Jupiter look like it does? Because it was managed by a committee, and they had to compromise, and that's why the missile looks like a crayon. The advent of Sputnik thrust both Jupiter and Thor into production. Three squadrons of Jupiter were deployed, two squadrons in Italy and one in Turkey, beginning in 1960. And it's generally known now, though it wasn't at the time, that Jupiter was withdrawn as a result of the Cuban Missile Crisis. This was not mentioned at the time, but it's generally acknowledged now that the missiles were taken out of Italy and Turkey a couple of months after the Russians withdrew theirs from Cuba as part of the agreement. Perhaps an unwritten or unspoken part of it, but they came right out of there. They were also obsolete by then, so it was no great hardship taking them out of there, but the Russians didn't want missiles so close to them, just like we didn't want missiles so close to us. The range, again, is about 1,500 miles, and this one was made by Chrysler. On to Titan I. We're still in the 60s. We haven't even reached the 1970s yet. Titan I was operational from 1962 to 1965. Do we have any Titan I folks in here? Do we have any Thor or Jupiter people in here? Okay. And so when things start getting thrown, it'll come from this direction. So Titan I, operational 1962 to 1965. It was created in parallel with and as a backup for Atlas, and also as a booster for future space launches. It was the first multi-stage American ICBM, and it had a tremendous range of 6,300 miles. Compare this to Jupiter and Thor. Wow, 6,300 miles. Now we can base missiles right in the heartland of the United States where they will be safe. It used radio inertial guidance, but it had one pretty giant drawback. Where's our Titan One person here? What was the drawback? The fuel, the cryogenic fuel. Liquid cryogenic oxidizer. They used liquid oxygen, and this was a big disadvantage. Liquid oxygen is extremely volatile and very hard to handle. It made managing this system a real chore, and that was the biggest disadvantage of this. The fuel had to be pumped aboard before launch, and this is always problematic. Lots of moving parts, lots of people, and a fair bit of danger. So that it wasn't as efficient as it could have been. The airframe, by the way, was made by Glenn L. Martin, later Martin Marietta. And Titan One, as you see here, I'm not keeping up with myself. Titan One had a relatively short career, 1962 to 65. But better propellants were on the way. Titan II was a big, big improvement on Titan One. It was operational from 1963 to 1987. It had a storable oxidizer, meaning that it didn't have to be super chilled, and you could store it aboard the missile. The oxidizer, for those of you who enjoy chemistry, was nitrogen tetroxide, and it also used a new fuel called Aerozine 50, which was a hypergolic fuel. Hypergolic means that it ignites spontaneously when it contacts the oxidizer. This is a revolution in both chemistry and missile technology. It meant that you could launch the missiles faster and more safely. It didn't make the missiles much smaller, but it did make them a bit easier to manage. Nonetheless, though, those are dangerous liquids. You don't want to get those on you. Titan II was a very long-lived system that had notable success in the civilian space program as well as a weapons system. It was useful in the Gemini program, and it spun off several variants essential to Air Force satellite launches. You will see a relative of Titan someday. Cross your fingers, it's coming soon. 208 foot of Titan IV will appear in a space gallery near you. It's going to be very exciting. I am really looking forward to that day when we can all walk under that enormous great beast of a rocket and learn all about it. This, like the other Titans, made by Glenn L. Martin and later Martin Marietta. On to Minuteman. I mentioned before that our rocket paradigm up to this point has included liquid fuels. You have two liquids that you mix together. They either ignite spontaneously or you light them. But now something different. Can we make a smaller missile and lots of them that you can just load like a bullet and leave it alone? And if you build thousands of them spread out all over the place, they'll be very easy to maintain with very few people, and they will do everything you need them to do without the tremendous infrastructure of liquid-fueled missiles. I wonder if we can do that. Minuteman turns out to be the first American solid-fuel ICBM. 800 A and B models of Minuteman were deployed. However, this was not a solidly successful design when it first came out. The first stage of this missile was somewhat flawed, and it reduced the system's expected range by about 2,000 miles. But because the perception was that we need this and we need this now. The Air Force went ahead and deployed Minuteman while pressing forward with the design of Minuteman II. Its range, like the concurrent Titan, was about 6,300 miles, and it featured all inertial guidance as well. This one was made by Boeing. Well, along comes Minuteman II, operational from 1965 to 1991. It featured improved range and payload because they fixed the problems with staging and propellant design and casings and all that stuff. It bettered Minuteman's range by about 700 miles to about 7,000 miles. By this time, we're developing what are called penetration aids for reentry vehicles. It's not just that the reentry vehicle is going to come down out of space so fast that you'll just never see it. The idea now is to make its approach to the target easier by spoofing the enemy's defensive systems. Now, they couldn't shoot down any missiles, but if we could fool them into thinking there's missiles everywhere, or this one isn't here, they may be less ready on the ground, wherever the real missile turns out to land. So these penetration aids are being developed to increase the anxiety on the other end of the missile. Minuteman II featured widely dispersed basing, and here's an example. A single wing could occupy as much as 15,000 square miles of real estate. That's 150 missiles at Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota. That took up 15,000 square miles. And that was the high for that. Others, you know, 12,000 or 13,000. But it's a huge piece of real estate. And I was talking with a gentleman before we started here about riding to and from work. Getting to and from work was an adventure because did you tell me that in the helicopter facing a headwind, people in cars below you were going faster? So helicopters not all as fast as you'd think. But it was a tremendous piece of work to get hither and yon to manage these missile fields that took up such a huge amount of space. As of 1990, there were 450 deployed. Now, I know we have a number problem on this, and perhaps somebody in the room can solve this for us. Well, we'll get to that with Minuteman III, won't we? Okay, so scrap the number problem for now. We'll come back to that. Up to Minuteman III, operational from 1970 to now, it was the first American ICBM that featured multiple independent reentry vehicles. Now your penetration aids don't have to fool the enemy into thinking several missiles are arriving when one is. You really do have several warheads arriving, all with penetration aids, all doing this other stuff. It multiplies the missile recipient's problem many, many, many fold, because now with one ICBM, you can target several places. This missile was designed with three MIRVs. Now, per treaty, it has just one. But it was designed to carry three warheads at a time. Initial deployment of this missile was 550. And I've got a big asterisk above my head here because we have this number issue. Initial deployment was 550, and now 500 remain deployed at three bases, F.E. Warren, Malmstrom in Montana, and Minot in North Dakota. Now, can you restate the question for us? Why are the numbers messed up? Okay, so that's 450. So where do the extra 50 Minuteman IIIs come from? Anybody know? Does this mean that the latest Air Force Almanac has a typo in it? Or is there something we don't know? I will endeavor to find out. I'll let Bonnie know as soon as I receive a Twix from my friends at Peterson. Who's received a Twix lately? At any rate, beyond the number question, the expected lifetime of this system with upgrades and modifications is about to 2020. That's when we expect Minuteman III to last until. This is made by Boeing, by the way. Finally, Peacekeeper, operational from 1986 to 2005. It had a tremendous MIRV capability. It was capable of carrying 21 reentry vehicles, but limited by treaty to 10 reentry vehicles. The development and basing of this missile, as many of you know, because it's recent experience, was problematic and controversial. I wish I knew more about this, and I intend to find out more about it before I have to write an exhibit about it. But the way I read it up to now is that A, it was about funding, and B, it was about protecting the missile force through a bunch of different basing solutions, all with their philosophical advantages and disadvantages. Do you super harden the silos and keep them all in a sort of tight grouping to withstand any hammer blow that comes? Or do you make them mobile in these mobile rail garrisons like we can see out here in the airpark and move them around like a shell game so that the enemy never knows quite exactly where your peacekeepers are? How are we going to do that? Lots and lots of argument back and forth, and as often happens, those arguments turn on funding questions. Well, that might be just as effective, but it'll cost 50 times more. Or, well, you know, money be darned, we've got to protect the missiles, and this is what will work. The other one won't work. They'll just develop a huge comet or something and just take out the whole state. So these things turn on both political and technical questions. And as I said, I intend to find out much more about that and perhaps can have a further presentation later about that whole controversy. One interesting technical thing about Peacekeeper was that it was capable of what's called a cold launch. This is not a missile that came all out of the ground spewing fire and brimstone. It was shot out of the ground and then ignited. So the thing would rise about 50 feet into the air and then it would ignite. That's what you see here in the picture. That's not thrust coming from any rocket motor there. That's compressed gas shooting the missile out of its silo. And those plates that you see on the side of it, I believe they call those cornflakes. They're simply pads that allow the missile to get out of the silo, and then they fall away. So to review all this thumbnail sketching of systems, I thought to myself, well, I'll create a timeline because I'd really like to kind of have a graphic picture of what we're dealing with here. And it looks like we get a lot of short-lived systems up into the mid-60s where we're learning and building at the same time. This is where concurrency in the systems approach allows you to have several things happening at once. You see, we don't have one missile system squarely after another. We have them all in an overlapping series. The early ones much more operationally short-lived than the later ones. The real successes that you get are Titan II, Minuteman II, Minuteman III, and even though Peacekeeper was eliminated by treaty and so on, it was, as far as I can tell, a good weapon system. It worked. It did what it was supposed to do, but was eliminated. So you have a couple of really big successes and a couple of shorter-lived learning steps. It depends on how you define successful. If you've learned a lesson and the next thing you build is really good and really long-lived, well, then I'd call the learning step a success too. So the timeline doesn't tell you everything, but it does give you some clues about the concurrency approach that are worth investigating further. I'm sure if you turned these facts around and like it did a money chart or something, things might look different or you'd learn something different. I want to say just some very brief words about things like guidance and warheads. Guidance is like magic. Anybody work on guidance systems here? is that delicate, complex, and a form of alchemy? I mean, how would you describe the kind of the effort and brains that goes into making those things? There you have it. Designed by people with brains this big, and the way these things are miniaturized and made super accurate is really, really quite remarkable. The general progression of guidance systems in Air Force missiles has been from radio inertial to all inertial. If you look at pictures of early Minuteman, I guess, you'll see these big antennas that come out of the ground and guide the missile by radio for its initial the first part of its journey. But lately, in the past several decades, guidance has been all inertial, which means that missile has to know exactly where it is starting from, and it has to take into account the rotation of the Earth and the season and the time of day and temperatures and latitude and longitude and all of this other stuff in order to make these minute calculations and guide this thing to within what's called a circular error probable that used to be measured in miles and is now measured in feet. You can launch a vehicle that will travel 6,000 or 7,000 miles and land within 100 or 200 feet of where you want it to. That is flat out remarkable. And as for the technology that goes into it, I don't understand it. But I'm going to try to figure it out. A lot of it's classified, and I'm not allowed to understand it. As for warheads, well, just as classified. But the general trend has been smaller and smaller and smaller, and more and more and more powerful. On the right, you see a Minuteman I reentry vehicle. That is a single warhead, and it's pretty big. On the left, a Peacekeeper reentry vehicle bus, the platform where they put all of those multiple independent reentry vehicles. So they get smaller and smaller, and they get more and more capable and more complex. And I believe, unless memory isn't serving, those are maintained at a company called Pantex in Texas. Amarillo, thank you. Amarillo, Texas, Pantex. I listened to a guy from Pantex give a presentation at the Wilson Center in Washington once, and everybody's eyes were as big as dinner plates. It was unbelievable, and we all thought, wow, you get to see that. You get to be there in that place. And then we all realized he's hanging around all these nuclear warheads. Wow, don't want to have that job. But he gave a very interesting presentation on what they do there. They recondition and maintain nuclear warheads. Wow. Talk about this security badge from hell. It must be a huge thing. It's probably in a backpack or something. Doctrine. I want to spend just a few minutes talking about some terms that we should be familiar with when we're talking with museum guests about how the United States and its defense establishment, and the Air Force in particular, has characterized the threat and our response to the nuclear threat during the Cold War. Here are some terms, just three of them, that we should all be pretty familiar with. Massive retaliation. In 1954, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles announced a policy of massive retaliation. He stated that in response to communist aggression anywhere in the world, the United States would reserve the right to use massive retaliatory power applied at places and with means of our own choosing. This meant that we have the bomb and you don't, and we will use it where we choose. It is, you cross the line and we're going to hammer you. That was the message. That was massive retaliation. Second term that we should all be familiar with is flexible response. In 1967, NATO announced a new nuclear strategy. It adopted a strategy known as flexible response. This abandons the strategy of massive retaliation and instead commits the alliance to respond to any aggression short of general nuclear attack at the level of force, conventional or nuclear, at which it was initiated. So this is a different animal. This isn't you take our half of Berlin and we nuke the whole Soviet Union. This is we retaliate at the same level at which the aggression was initiated. However, there's a caveat. NATO retained the option to use nuclear weapons first if its initial response to a conventional attack proved inadequate. And if necessary, they reserved the right to deliberately escalate to general nuclear war. So flexible response meant just that. Flexibility. We will not absolutely wipe out the enemy for a small transgression. We will retaliate in kind, but we reserve the right to go much further if that doesn't deter the enemy. So this is an evolution. This is because they now have nuclear weapons as well. And they've proven that they can send objects around the Earth in orbit, and their rocket force is every bit as deadly as ours. Mutual assured destruction. This arose from a concept in the early 60s known as assured destruction. This was a sort of internal Air Force notion, assured destruction, that was a recognition that a certain number of Minuteman missiles could survive a first strike and certainly destroy the Soviet Union, even if the U.S. was attacked first. So this was assured destruction. If we have enough Minuteman, out there, enough of them will survive a first strike to destroy the enemy. So their destruction is assured. Mutual assured destruction was popularized by the Johnson administration, and it was also known by another name, finite deterrence. And I like finite deterrence even better as a Cold War phraseology, because mutual assured destruction really is finite. That's the end. It's all over. Mutual assured destruction is simply the recognition that both sides would perish in a nuclear exchange, making nuclear war unthinkable and therefore impossible. The ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, is based on this kind of thinking, the concept of a standoff, and that a standoff is too dangerous for either party to act. Peace is maintained by mutual terror and knowledge of the assured destruction of all combatants. So you move from massive retaliation, where one side has a great technical advantage over the other, or force advantage, to flexible response, which is a recognition that both sides now have a tremendous destructive capability. We will be more measured, but we reserve the right to ratchet up the force when we see fit. And then playing into all this, from the 1960s and beyond, is the idea of mutual assured destruction that keeps the peace by forcing two giant populations and the rest of the world to realize that if this happens, if everybody launches everything, we're all finished. And so this is the kind of calculus that gives you this balance between a feeling of safety and a feeling of nervousness at the same time. The strategic missile forces assuredly let us all sleep safely at night, but at the same time we knew that the other side had a bunch of those as well, and they were pointed at us, and there's a good bit of history and fiction and literature and plays and movies and poetry devoted to that kind of ironic tension. That there's so much destructive power out there, but we're managing to use it to keep the peace, a well-armed peace. An update to these terms is the NATO London Declaration of July 1990. As the Soviet Union weakened and the security environment in Europe changed fundamentally, NATO undertook to redefine its nuclear strategy. In the London Declaration, NATO announced a review of the alliance's political and military strategy to reflect a, quote, reduced reliance on nuclear weapons. It led to the adoption of a new NATO strategy, making nuclear weapons truly the weapons of last resort, which we hoped that really and truly they always were. Depending on who you talk to, these weapons have been absolutely necessary because we knew that the other side was going to make them as well, but not something that we really thought or felt good about actually using because they're so tremendously destructive. But it's a set of ironies that you can consider for years. And there's no end to the argument of useful or necessary or not. Yes, Squire. Oh, certainly. I'm sorry. I didn't. Those are peacekeeper reentry vehicles coming in to the South Pacific. That was a test launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base. I don't recall the actual date of that test, but it's sort of a time exposure of the RVs reentering. So that's what you would have seen. That's the last thing that you would have seen. So, and I'm sure all of us can remember there were TV movies and so on called the Day After, which was billed on television as the most terrifying thing you've ever seen on television, and children were cautioned to be with their parents. And I think that was in, unless I miss my guess, it was in 1982 or 83. And it was supposed to be the scariest thing ever. It was one of those, you know, on the beach experiences. What happens if there really is a nuclear war? This is how it is. If you watch that now, it will seem a little bit curious to you, like, wow, were we really that scared? A lot of people really were that scared. It's a really remarkable thing to live through. And some of you who were on the military and of managing those systems, perhaps you were in missile maintenance, perhaps you were a launch officer, you have a particular point of view about your responsibilities and your training and your purpose and so on that are really, really fascinating. And those are stories that we're eager to tell here. Once we get the new space and missile gallery going and we can more fully tell the story of the ballistic missile force, I look forward to spending a lot of firsthand time with people who spent multi-thousands of hours doing things so exactly perfectly right that they could not ever make a mistake. I admire people who are actually capable of doing that. I think that's really something. So I will be calling you to talk with you for hours and hours about how these things work so that we can explain them to general public persons. Just a brief word about command. Strategic Air Command was in charge of ballistic missiles all the way through the Cold War. So lots of SAC veterans in the room, right? In 1982, Air Force Space Command comes along. Missile warning and space operations were combined in 1982 to form Air Force Space Command. ICBM forces were integrated into the Space Command structure in 1993. And a thumbnail sketch of today's Air Force Space Command tells us that there are about 39,000 people in Space Command, including about 25,000 active duty and civilians, 13,700 contractors, and all of these are combining to perform all of Space Command's missions. 20th Air Force, which manages the ICBMs, is located at F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. 20th Air Force operates and maintains the nation's ICBM weapon systems in support of U.S. Strategic Command war plans. Air Force Space Command, by the way, is the only Air Force command to have its acquisition arm within the command. It's not down the street at AFMC headquarters. It is within Space Command. In 2002, on recommendation from the Space Commission, Space Command was assigned its own four-star commander after previously sharing a commander with U.S. Space Command and NORAD. So the operations and the priorities and the equipment for the space mission are different enough that they have their own acquisition arm, and Air Force Space Command now has its own four-star commander. So that is how different this activity is than much of what the rest of the Air Force does. The last thing that I want to spend just a few minutes on is some landmarks of arms control. Now, you could go weeks and weeks and weeks studying what happened in arms control during the Cold War. But this is part of that sort of ironic tension of building a tremendously powerful, efficient, and effective force, yet trying to shrink it at the same time, and trying to shrink the enemy's force at the same time, too. So there's an acknowledgement that these weapons are unprecedented in their power, and they must be managed effectively. And so this is what the U.S. government over the years has done. 1952, the U.S. presents the Atoms for Peace plan. That, in a nutshell, led to the creation of the International Atomic Energy Agency in 1957. So what we're doing at this early point is building structures to manage all things nuclear internationally, building cooperative organizations that are supposed to monitor, advise, inspect, and so on. 1963, the U.S., Britain, and the Soviet Union signed the Limited Test Ban Treaty, barring nuclear testing in the atmosphere, underwater, and in outer space. It entered into force in October 1963, ironically. So control over nuclear weapons testing is enacted in the early 1960s. 1968, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. U.S. and 61 other nations sign it. It obligates states without nuclear weapons at the time to not make or acquire them, and it required all parties to pursue negotiations on arms control and disarmament. It was extended indefinitely in 1995. Read Korea, North Korea, and Iran as problematic players versus the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. 1969, the U.S. and the Soviet Union opened the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks, otherwise known as SALT I. In Helsinki to discuss placing limits on strategic nuclear offensive weapons and anti-ballistic missile systems. In 1972, President Nixon and Soviet General Secretary Leonid Brezhnev signed the basic SALT I documents limiting strategic offensive arms. And SALT I, by the way, expired in October 1977. 1972, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Remember I mentioned that the ABM Treaty was made possible by the notion of mutual assured destruction. MAD falls apart if you can prevent the missiles from landing. So the ABM Treaty, in theory, and this is strange Cold War logic, by preventing defense, you also prevent offense. So if you make it impossible to shoot down the incoming warheads, you'll make sure that nobody launches incoming warheads at you because they can do it at each other. This is the logic of how this works. 1969, the U.S. and the Soviet Union signed the SALT II Treaty in Vienna, replacing SALT I. The SALT II Treaty was never ratified. Following the December 1979 invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviet Union, President Carter withdrew the SALT II Treaty from Senate consideration. It was never ratified. 1987, the U.S. and the Soviet Union sign the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. to eliminate all intermediate and short-range land-based nuclear missiles. This is the first arms control agreement to eliminate an entire class of nuclear weapons. It featured an extensive and comprehensive verification regime, including on-site inspections and so on. The treaty entered into force in 1988 and was fully implemented in 1991. Anybody ever been to Woensdrecht in Holland to see where the Air Force had its? I think they had Glickums there. I only mention that because I got to go there once, and it was a really fascinating place to go. But the INF treaty was 1987. Finally, 1991, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty cut long-range nuclear forces from a Cold War high of between 11,000 and 12,000 warheads to between 6,000 and 7,000 for each side. That treaty entered into force on December the 5th, 1994. These are all things that you can look up. If you just fire up the Google and type in Cold War chronology or arms control chronology, you'll find these landmarks and many others too. And you'll see that I'm probably beating a radioactive horse here, but there's a growth of the force and efforts to shrink it as well, all at the same time. Whatever your feelings about that, you have to admit it worked. There was not a nuclear war, or there hasn't been. And if you're only looking at what did happen, you can chalk it up to the fact that the forces were effective, they were run well, they were staffed well, they were maintained well, and they did what they were supposed to do. They prevented the kind of nuclear war that has been imagined in fiction, and thank goodness it's fiction, the worldwide nuclear holocaust. This has been imagined in fiction many times, and the Air Force and Air Force people played a tremendous part in preventing that from happening. And that's one of those big Air Force stories that once we get the new space gallery up and running, I'll spend about 30 years filling that gallery with interpretation of that.